Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice, the only podcast that tells you what's really happening in Seattle politics. I'm David Hyde, and it's Thursday, October 2nd. Federal troops haven't invaded the city yet. So far, we've got that going for us. Erica C. Barnett of Publicola.
Hey, David. We do have that going for us.
Yeah. Also with us, political consultant Sandeep Kaushik, who has his ear to the ground. Sandeep, when is the invasion going to begin?
Maybe I'm just overly competitive with Portland, but I feel like, you know, how come they got the federal troops and not us? I'm feeling a little left out.
We're being left out. On today's show, we're not talking about that. More turbulence at the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Also, on the stump, Mayor Bruce Harrell saying voters should reject challenger Katie Wilson for a reason that Erica wants to talk about. But first, Mayor Harrell's proposed ban on anti-competitive covenants, Erica, which is basically when a company closes a grocery store or a pharmacy, and then that company can add a restrictive covenant or deed on the lease, and that can block new grocery stores or pharmacies for a certain number of years. Backers are saying this is going to prevent future food deserts, but you are skeptical.
Just one detail that you missed is that it's about the size. It's not about them actually preventing the a pharmacy or grocery store from going there. I don't know that they can do that. But the examples that the mayor brought up in this press release and announcement this week that got some coverage on King and Como are grocery stores that have put covenants on their the sale of their property that say you can't be any bigger than, in one case, I think it's 28,000 square feet, and the other it's 20,000. And so he is presenting this as a way of responding to food deserts in Seattle, which is, you know, a problem that happens, that is happening with a lot of grocery stores and also pharmacies closing, particularly in Southwest and Southeast Seattle. And I wrote a piece today, as we're recording on Thursday, about sort of why I think this is a press release in search of a problem.
Look, I do think there's a kind of simmering issue municipally about, you know, Bartels. They just got announced that the last of the Bartels stores are getting shut down because of the Rite Aid bankruptcy. Rite Aid had bought them a few years ago, and the stores have been slowly closing one by one, and they're all going away. And obviously, there was a lot of attention paid to the fact that the Fred Meyer in Lake City is shutting down. Neighbors there certainly kind of happy. So this has been in the air that, you know, there's a feeling that neighborhoods are losing some of the retail, grocery and drugstores that are, you know, kind of, you know, key to the fabric of quality of life for a lot of folks. And so there's this kind of scramble to do stuff. I mean, the mayor announced this, but remember a couple of weeks ago, Katie Wilson had a press conference where she announced that she announced the UFCW endorsement, the grocery store workers union endorsement. But at that, she said that she's going to explore publicly owned grocery stores in Seattle to address this kind of food desert problem. So they both seem to be scrambling to kind of put something out there saying they're addressing it.
Yeah, and that kind of does highlight a pretty clear difference between the candidates. Katie Wilson kind of going the Zoran Mondami route, saying we need the public to intervene to help with these food deserts, right, Erica? Bruce Harrell and other liberals basically saying, no, we should lobby the state to exempt groceries and pharmacies from the B&O tax and help the private sector do the stuff the private sector can do, as well as this idea, and save our public dollars for other stuff like food assistance. But what do you think?
Just to go back a little bit to the idea that the mayor announced this week. So he said that he's going to propose emergency legislation, and it's emergency because this is such a problem. Sarah Nelson's going to sponsor it for the city council. Of course, both of them are up for election this year. And, I looked at, they gave a couple of examples. They said they had found two examples of these covenants that were restricting grocery stores. And I looked at them, both in North Seattle. One is in Greenwood, one's in Haller Lake. Haller Lake is maybe a little more of a food desert than Greenwood certainly is. But both of the sites that they named when I asked are the site of grocery stores now. One was an Albertsons that had been basically abandoned and had sat there unused for years until a Sprouts came in. And it is a smaller grocery store, but, you know, it's also surrounded by other grocery stores. There's an Asian grocery store. There's an Amazon Fresh. And there's a Safeway a little bit up the road, not super convenient, but a Safeway nearby, about a mile and a half north. In the other instance, it was, this is the one in Greenwood, a Safeway, which is, you know, a one-story, very car-oriented kind of Safeway store, closed down because there is a very large new mixed-use development there with hundreds of new apartments and a Trader Joe's. So, I mean, neither of those examples is really the kind of food desert that Harold is talking about, and nor are they examples where grocery stores, you know, closed down and weren't replaced. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying this is a bad idea. I suppose there could be an example in some theoretical future instance where a grocery store in Southeast Seattle closes down and, you know, puts a restriction on the size of a future grocery store. But I don't think we've seen that yet. I think the real problem is that, you know, like you mentioned, I mean, Rite Aid, Bartels, you know, places are closing. And, you know, if you go up in Ballard, I think we talked about this before, but you go sort of to the Town and Country store, the former Ballard Market. I mean, there's like, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 stores right around there offering all kinds of groceries. So, I mean,
the pharmacies are closing, though. My pharmacy, the Bartels near the library, went out of business, as you said, with the closures. And
yeah, and I'm not aware of any pharmacies that have put this kind of restricted covenant on their property. I mean, again, the examples were grocery stores. And in both cases, I mean, the Trader Joe's in particular, it's such a better use of that land to have apartments there. And, you know, Trader Joe's is always kind of a small grocery store. I mean, they're not going to build a, you know, a giant mega market. And there's a Fred Meyer 4 blocks away. So it's not like that is a food desert.
So it's kind of preventative legislation. It may not solve the problem based on the evidence.
I mean, I think it's performative legislation more than preventative. I mean, I think this is election year legislation to look like the mayor's doing something about this issue that keeps coming up on the campaign trail.
But there are, as I mentioned, those philosophical differences, right? Him also saying, let's lobby the state to exempt grocery stores and pharmacies from the B&O tax, you know, let the private sector do what the private sector can do. And then let's spend our precious public dollars on things like food assistance. Katie Wilson saying, no, let's consider the idea of city-owned grocery stores. And Sandeep brought that up. What do you think of those two possibilities? Which one do you prefer, Erica?
Well, I mean, I don't know the implications of giving a big tax exemption to, you know, grocery corporations like Kroger. I mean, I don't know enough about that. But if the implication is, let's, you know, exempt them from business and occupation taxes, I mean, those things pay for stuff, you know, in our tax system. I mean, it's when we give tax breaks to corporations, there are impacts to the budget. So, I mean, I think that, again, not knowing, you know, exactly what the budgetary impacts would be and not knowing what the exact proposal is, if there is one. I mean, it seems like something that, you know, we'd need to take a closer look at than, you know, just saying that grocery stores are good, so they should get a tax break. I mean, these companies are not closing because, I mean, they're closing because of profit motive. They're not closing, you know, because Seattle hasn't been nice enough to them. So, you know, I'm a little skeptical of that idea, if it is just a blanket exemption. And then, you know, public grocery stores, we've talked about before, I'm, you know, interested to see how that would work and, you know, whether it would be truly government run. You know, I talked on KUOW a couple weeks ago about the fact that, you know, the U.S. military runs socialized grocery stores for, you know, military families. And my family is a military family. And, you know, that's where they get their groceries and one branch of my family. So I don't know. I mean, it's not the craziest idea. I don't think Katie Wilson would be opposed to some of the stuff that Harold has proposed doing in the budget with one-time funds to, you know, support like FreshBooks and stuff. I just think that, you know, what we're doing is actually really inadequate right now. And I think the city overall in general does not appreciate the shitstorm that's coming in terms of federal budget cuts. And we're doing these tiny little things here and there. So, I mean, that's a bigger picture question, though.
So I would say, first of all, I mean, obviously, that I think the mayor's argument here is that by giving them this B&O tax break, that makes them these stores more profitable and maybe it keeps them open. But But that said, I'm kind of with you that I'm not sure this is where I'd go policy-wise. If you want to encourage the development of more grocery stores in Seattle, like, you know, handing out sort of, you know, tax exemptions kind of willy-nilly, you know, without doing your homework on it doesn't seem like the greatest policy making to me either.
What about it? What about if it's targeted in areas that we're actually looking at potential closures where we're worried about food deserts? I mean, as Erica says, I live in an area where there's like 5 grocery stores. I don't know if we can handle anymore. I will say the prices are like insane. But what about if it was targeted? I think if it's a blanket exemption, that seems a little bit ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you could do some kind of targeted thing where you encouraged the development of certain kinds of, like, you know, drugstores or grocery stores in neighborhoods where they didn't exist with some economic incentives. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I will say this. We throw up a whole lot of other roadblocks to the operations of grocery stores and drugstores. You know, when the Fred Meyer closed the one at Lake City, one of the things that got cited there was crime and shoplifting that was happening, right? And that was causing them to lose money and hurting their bottom line. I would also point out, like, there was a case just recently of a grocery store wanting to open in Wedgewood, right, in the shopping center where the Wedgewood Broiler was located. There's, again, this kind of development where they're going to build a ton of housing as well as a grocery store. And it got all hung up in design review, right, where there was a curb cut that the grocery store company needed to, you know, to make it all pencil and work. And initially, I think it got voted down or preliminarily voted down. It did get passed by design review last week. So that is going forward, but only after like months of, you know, delay and uncertainty and all of this sort of rigmarole about, you know, for what? Right? Like, why are we creating those kinds of impediments, right? Why don't we wash some of that shit away before we start handing out tax breaks?
Yeah. And I mean, Bruce Harrell has talked a lot about getting rid of red tape and making it easier to build stuff. And one of the things that he's discussed is, you know, getting rid of design review, right? But and the state has sort of forced Seattle's hand on that, as they have on a lot of things. But this project up in Wedgewood, I mean, would have had to go through design review regardless, because they were seeking, you know, some exemptions, including that curb cut. And it throws it into this process where it isn't just about the curb cut. It's about, do we want the childcare center to be on this specific corner, or do we want, you know, as a group of volunteers to force it to be located somewhere else? Or do we want to allow them to put up pictures of produce in the store windows at the grocery store, or do they have to display actual physical produce? I mean, it just gets so picayune. And I mean, it's to the level of just, you know, bullshit obstructionism at every single one of these processes. When you're talking about, you know, a big project like this, that it's honestly, it's a wonder that anything ever gets built. And of course, it did get resolved, but they are still going to put conditions on it in the future. So it's resolved, but it's not resolved. The project can at least go forward. It wasn't going to go forward if they hadn't gotten this curb cut on 35th up in Wedgewood, but they're still going to put conditions on it. I mean, they always talk about the fucking bricks. That's the thing I always come back to, you know, in all these meetings. They're like, what will the bricks look like? What color will the concrete be? I mean, this is not stuff that a serious big city should be debating in these, you know, in these little meetings and stopping projects because of. It's just, I can't believe we're still doing this. I've been covering the city for, you know, a couple decades, and this is where we were 20 years ago.
Right. I mean, look, we've talked about like the Historical Landmark Commission before. We've talked about design review. There's a lot of this stuff where these sort of activist types could put on these kind of obscure commissions, and everybody thinks they're fucking Jane Jacobs, and like, you know, they've got to like, they're saving Grand Central Station by making produce pictures turn into live produce in the grocery store or whatever, right?
Choreographing the sidewalk ballet by telling a childcare it can't be, you know, on a corner.
One factual thing. I do think my understanding is what the mayor was planning to do is next year in the spring, assuming he gets reelected, you know, big question mark there, we'll see what happens in November, was to initiate a process along with, I think, Councilmember Dan Strauss around looking at reforming design review. But my sense of what I've heard about that is they're not contemplating. What I would recommend is just get rid of the whole fucking process, right? Like, it's just...
They had to pass interim legislation because of the state law that changed this year. So yes, they are late on that, as they were with the comp plan. So it's an interim law, but in any, I mean, it doesn't matter. This project would have still had to go through design review, you know, under that legislation, just because they're asking for some exemptions, like height exemptions and things like that.
But my point is, in terms of reforming it going forward, my concern from what I'm hearing is that they're just going to, like, let's say they do this process in the spring, they'll freaking tinker around the edges and, but basically, like, leave the whole edifice in place, and it's going to continue to cause the sorts of delays and cost increases and frustrations and all, you know, what have you, over this sort of penny ante minor stuff, right? With that, and you know, that's classic Seattle, right? We sort of pretend to like fix something, but we kind of just sort of make little minor tweaks, and we don't have the, you know, basically the balls to like do anything different.
Yeah, it's also like coming up with panaceas. I mean, yeah, you can go after design review, but the issue here, Sandeep, is that these stores aren't profitable. They already have their locations. You're talking about building new stores, but they're not profitable in the locations that they already have. So you're not actually addressing the problem that we're talking about right now by dealing with the question of design review, in my opinion.
Well, I will say, too, we don't know if they're profitable.
Yeah, I don't know what the solution is, but I would say, again, like, you know, the argument is about whether or not you want to put city dollars behind city-owned grocery stores or try to help the private sector keep stores open in places where the private sector is already doing that, and then saving your precious public dollars for other stuff, like helping really poor people with actual food rather than creating a whole bunch of city jobs for UFCW 3000 workers or whatever. Because,
well, I think we're a little too obsessed with this like one grocery store that might open or whatever. I
mean, I'm just saying it's a philosophical difference that underscores some differences between the two sides. And on this particular issue, I mean, I have mixed feelings about both of these candidates, but on this particular issue, I think I would prefer to see the private sector do stuff that the private sector is already doing and can do. It's, grocery is not a very profitable business to begin with. I don't love my grocery stores. They charge me way too much as it is. But on the other hand, I don't know. You know, on the other hand, it's like, yeah, we got to get groceries into places where there are food deserts. And so somebody better do something.
I think that we don't have the data. I mean, I think that the Retail Federation and, you know, the grocery lobby makes a lot of assertions. The Retail Federation had to retract a pretty major claim a couple of years ago about retail theft. I think that those stats are incredibly fishy, or, you know, at least not really stats. I mean, it's just a lobby group making some claims that they don't back up with specific data. And I think the same thing is true of profitability claims about grocery stores. I'm not saying it's not an incredibly small margin business, but I don't know enough to say to confidently assert, you know, that they're closing specific grocery stores down because they aren't profitable. My point was just, you know, the reason that Ballard has a zillion grocery stores is because it's a richer neighborhood and people have a lot of money to spend at PCC and H Mart and, you know, all these other stores that are up there, which are like, you know, I don't know where you shop, David, but they are all insanely expensive. So that was my only point.
I go to all of them and I hate all of them because they're too expensive. Yeah. But I will say, you know, like H Mart the other day, I was very excited when it opened up and I just was like, Jesus, like, oh my God, stuff's anyway. But I don't get this argument. Like, I don't want to belabor the point, but like, if I'm closing a Starbucks, it's because it's not that profitable at that location anymore. If I'm making money, why would I close it?
Hey, Seattle Nice listeners. Seattle politics got you low? Well, get high with Uncle Ike's. Pissed at the mayor? Relax with a dollar joint. Pop a tire in a pothole? Eat a $2 gummy and chill. Whether you need something to pump you up for Saturday's protest or a mellow strain for your next sit-in, Ike's is your best friend. Now is the time to roll up, Seattle. Download the Ike's app today or head on over to Ike's.com. That's Ike's.com.
Well, I mean, because companies don't make decisions. I mean, just getting in the mind of a company, it's not just like they're like, ooh, look at this Starbucks here. It's not profitable. I mean, I think that is a that is not how major corporations make individual decisions about store closures. I think that it is a national plan. I mean, Kroger, for example, is closing, I don't remember exactly how many, but, you know, dozens of stores across the country. And again, as I said, like, I mean, they'd rather be in rich neighborhoods. That's why we have food deserts. It's not just that, like, it's not profitable or they couldn't make money being in the Rainier Valley. It's because they can make more money being around where the rich people are.
2 points, guy. I want to come back to the public-owned grocery store too. But look at Bartels, a longtime chain, quite successful when it was locally owned, right? And there were 55, 60 stores. Now, they were having some issues, you know, starting to have some issues financially. There are definitely some cost pressures and all that stuff on drugstores, and the high cost of doing business in Seattle is, I think, an issue not just for drugstores, but for a lot of businesses, lower margin businesses, including groceries. That said, like, Bartels ran a pretty successful chain till they sold out to Rite Aid, which is this massive national conglomerate that took on a massive amount of debt and basically, like, destroyed the, you know, the personalized customer service and, you know, product lines of these stores and lost a lot of business. So look, I'm for trying to figure out how we can like use the private sector to incentivize good stuff to happen. But, you know, I'm kind of with the lefties on some of this, like look at, you know, this is fucking Rite Aid's fault. Like they seem like they're a shittily run company that made,
I think that's just a fact.
Yeah. Bad financial decisions and sort of fucked up these successful, you know, drugstores. And then, you know, all right, well, somebody else ought to come back to replace them, you know. But coming back to just the publicly owned grocery stores things, look, I do think this is a silly idea. I will say, like, I think Katie Wilson, she gestured at this. She didn't actually commit to it. You know, I'm going to, quote unquote, explore it or whatever. I don't know what that means.
She also said city backed as opposed to city owned, I think. Is that right?
Well, yeah, it's all vague. She hasn't, there's no details to any of this, and we don't know what's going to happen, if anything, if she wins. And, but I will just say this, like, you know, this publicly owned grocery stores idea, obviously Zoran Mamdani in New York is talking about it, but Brandon Johnson, right? Probably the most unpopular big city mayor in the country, mayor of Chicago, ran 3 years ago on publicly owned grocery stores. And then he created a commission to look at it. And the commission sort of quietly decided this is a really bad, unworkable idea. And they didn't do it, right? Like, so I'll believe it when I see it, that somebody's going to come up with and run a publicly owned grocery store. I mean, it immediately gets into all sorts of questions, right? About how you would do it and how you run them and all that stuff. So I'm doubtful that that's a real solution to anything either.
Erica, more turbulence at the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. Is it time to land or ground the plane for good?
The turbulence this week was news that which I reported on Publicola, that the KCRHA, the Homelessness Authority, has basically given Kelly Kinnison, its CEO, a slap on the wrist for a bunch of complaints. I believe there were at least four complaints about her and her management style and practices. And so, you know, the possible penalties for what she was accused of were everything from, you know, getting fired to nothing. I reported a few weeks ago that she was accused of basically trying to go around the regular hiring process to hire two top level executive staff, both of whom were white men, into new positions, making $200,000 a year at a time when, you know, the agency is, morale is very low. The agency is obviously being subject to questions like, is it time to shut it down? That you just asked, David. And they are probably going to have to lay off a bunch of staff, because the city is not funding, you know, their administrative needs to the extent that they say they need them to. So really bad situation that I think was actually made worse when the KCRHA's governing board voted to basically send a sternly worded letter reminding Kelly Kinnison, CEO, not to retaliate against people, and gave her executive coaching for the rest of the year at a cost of about $67,000.
So what I don't know here, right, is about this whole thing, about these complaints that were filed against the, you know, the current CEO. Remember, Kelly Kinnison came in to take over what was, you know, a borderline dysfunctional agency, an agency that had been racked with a lot of, you know, internal process problems, as well as, you know, externally facing scandals and stuff like that. You know, it had stabilized somewhat under the interim, but there were clearly still some issues here. So what I don't understand about this whole hoo-ha, right, that happened is this something where you got a CEO coming in saying, oh boy, we got some wrong, you know, we got some personnel that aren't doing a very good job, and I need to kind of, you know, bring in some new people to fix this. And then the personnel whose oxes are getting gored are retaliating by kind of making these claims about racial, you know, hiring and what have you, or whether she's a, you know, actually a shitty manager and CEO. I don't know. Right. I have no idea. I wouldn't put it that binary,
but yeah. I mean, that's not how I would phrase a binary. I don't think that anybody is retaliating against, you know, the CEO of the KCRJ by filing complaints.
Let's put it this way. There's been a lot of stuff, a lot of turmoil in progressive organizations over the last 5 years where allegations that higher ups were, you know, acting in high-handed or sometimes racist ways or making decisions. That's been something that's kind of roiled a lot of progressive, culturally progressive organizations, nonprofits, and governmental institutions and stuff over recent years. I mean, that's not just a Seattle thing. I think that's a national thing. There's been a lot written about that. So, you know, I do think sometimes some of these sorts of allegations get weaponized to settle bureaucratic scores or whatever. Like I'm not saying that that's the case in this situation. I just don't know.
Yeah, well, so going back to my reporting on this, I had no indication that it was quite a few people, including the deputy CEO, who raised these concerns. The deputy CEO, Simon Foster, said in an email that, you know, he was very concerned that this was going to create a perception that, you know, that this was a racialized hiring decision. In other words, that she prefers to work with white men. And B, you know, at a time when they are saying that they're going to have to cut up to 22 people, this is not the time to be hiring two new top level executive staff, which I think is, you know, a very reasonable thing to say kind of in any organization that found itself in their financial position, right? But I mean, I don't think that when you look at, you know, four or five or six complaints that all resulted from this, you know, really terrible meeting that I wrote about a couple weeks ago, again on Publicola, that they're all just sort of collectively getting together and retaliating for some reason because they're all bad at their jobs or whatever. I think that is less likely than that there is like a real concern about morale and a real concern that there is something, you know, whether it's racial bias or whether it's just sort of blindness to how this looks to hire these top positions to everybody else in the organization. And I will say, I mean, I hear consistently across the board that morale is in the tank and it's worse than it's ever been. So that's a problem no matter what.
Obviously, Erica's reporting is really thorough here. But have we had dysfunction at the King County Regional Homeless Authority for from the beginning in a lot of ways? And what concerns me is that I wish people could figure this out, because the people who are actually suffering are not the people within that organization. It's people struggling. I mean, they are, but we're talking about people struggling with untreated mental illness, addiction, overdosing, people being victimized by violence, living on the streets. That's what this organization is there to fix. And here's these internal struggles happening within this organization whose job it is to fix that. And that is incredibly frustrating for people in this region who actually care about this. And so, you know, can our leaders, whoever they are, get their shit together and make this work? I mean, I don't care how it happens, honestly.
Right. And just to weigh in on that, like, because look, this is an organization, as we've been saying, I mean, I think we've all, I don't know whether all of us, but I've certainly been saying for a while that KCRHA should just have the plug pulled on it, let's write it off as a failure, because it is a failure. Leave my opinions aside, it's clearly been an organization that's been on thin ice for a while after all of the internal problems and turmoils that you've been citing, David. And they're not in a place where they can afford to have continuing dysfunction and turmoil. And it looks like that dysfunction and turmoil, whoever's responsible or whatever the power dynamics within the bureaucracy are and whoever's right or wrong, the organization clearly, as Erica's saying, has terrible morale. There are all these accusations flying around, attacking the CEO. The board's having to spend all this time dealing with that as opposed to, like, you know, dealing with the actual outward facing problem of homelessness. And for the first time, I am hearing, you know, some of the key elected officials from the mayor on down, I think, starting to publicly raise the idea that maybe King County RHA should not continue on, right? I do think there's the patience has all but run out. We'll see what happens going forward, but I'm starting to really think that, you know, KCRHA may not be around that much longer.
And I guess my question then is like, and then what? I mean, right. It's not as if there is a viable alternative that these folks are proposing. And that's what concerns me. Like, okay, so fine, we pull the plug on KCRHA. I mean, it was, you know, doomed in some ways from the beginning because it wasn't allowed to raise its own money. And so it sort of depends on the vagaries.
Yeah, no very limited suburban buy-in for an organization.
Well, I don't even think that, I don't really want to get into how much the suburbs could even really reasonably contribute financially. But my point was that, you know, it is a flawed structure because they can't raise their own money, for one thing. And it's now run entirely by elected officials with political, you know, inclinations. And Bruce Harrell is running for mayor again, and he keeps throwing around numbers that suggest that the KCRHA is doing a bad job of extracting money and support from places that aren't Seattle. And so my question then does become like, okay, so what is your alternative? I mean, so do we just go back to the system where King County did some stuff and the city did some stuff and the amount that the city did was basically determined by what the politics are, you know, in any given budget year and who's running for election and how much money do we have and are there progressives on the city council? I mean, that's not a better system either. And so I'm just very concerned that and people aren't really thinking or at least not really talking about what's going to replace the KCRHA if they just decide to get rid of it. I think we just go back to the old system.
You put your finger on it, Erica. I mean, what is Bruce Harrell's responsibility here? He's neither responsible nor not responsible. That's the problem with a kind of nameless organization like this. We can't hold it or him really accountable for what's going on here. Sandeep?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, that's a problem too. I mean, if you're Bruce Harrell, you were really frustrated for a long time because you were providing the vast bulk of the funding for this organization. And then the previous CEO of it was kind of telling you he didn't want to do the stuff that you wanted him to do in the city of Seattle. Like, you know, and take the issue of
well,
tiny.
It's supposed to be an independent agency.
But that's where, to your point, this was always structurally flawed because it never really was an independent agency. It did not have its own taxing authority. Therefore, it was completely dependent on pass-through money and handouts from the city and the county and, you know, a pittance from the suburbs. And therefore, all of those elected officials are like, we're providing all the funding. Why the fuck aren't you doing what we want? Right. Like, and why would we give you all our funding when you won't build the tiny homes we want, or you won't, you know, clean up encampments the way we want them, or do they out, you know, so that's where it kind of blew up. Right. You know, where if you're an elected official, including on the council and previous council, left and center, were frustrated in the same way because they wanted stuff had to happen that wasn't happening with city dollars.
I also think we have to kind of pull back big picture and, you know, and I think that this is something that honestly really frustrates me about the current administration and the city council. They are not discussing what it's actually going to mean when HUD stops doing Section 8 in Seattle, when, you know, when those dollars just go away, which is more likely than not, you know, when continuum of care funding drops off a cliff and all this federal money that actually, you know, funds a huge part of our system, including all those Section 8 vouchers that keep people from becoming homeless, goes away. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a crisis level, catastrophe level situation. And Bruce Harrell, you know, is out here and, I know it sounds like I'm picking on him and I am, but it's not just him, you know, it's also county leaders. It's also the city council and other cities, you know, but in any case, Bruce Harrell's out here saying we pay for all this money for these people who aren't even from here. And it's like, you know, we may be looking at a situation where we need to double the amount we're spending on homelessness, or we're going to see thousands and thousands more people visibly homeless on the street. And that's not happening, you know, in the next 10 years. That's happening like in the next year. And so I think that there's just a real lack of big picture thinking, you know, with these kind of picayune battles over, oh, you know, we spend $200 million and we really want to only be spending $150 million. It feels very like kind of typical Seattle, small-minded, not big picture thinking to me.
And speaking of Bruce Harrell, he's running for re-election, in case we haven't mentioned it 10 times already this episode. And at a recent debate, he talked up his experience. Here's what he said.
Experience matters. This is not the time to hope. Passion and great ideas and inexperience is just not going to get us there. Trump will walk all over a person without experience. Period.
Trump will walk all over a person without experience. Okay, Erica, you've been Instagramming about this. Am I right?
Yeah, I put up a reel about it.
As a former politics reporter, I will say, like, over the years, and I know that you've heard the same thing, which is that experience actually, of course, does matter, sometimes more than ideology. There's a lot of stuff that the city needs to get done. And we talked about the inexperience of the current council, kind of the class of 2023, when it came in. So on the one hand, experience, but of course, experience isn't everything. There's also questions about effective governance. So what do you think about this? Is this a cheap shot on Harold's part?
Well, I mean, it is the obvious thing to say that Katie Wilson doesn't have experience in government because she doesn't. I think that Bruce Harrell saying that he will stand up to Trump is interesting. I haven't seen a plan out of the mayor's office other than a lot of bluster about how we're going to deal with those National Guard troops if they do come in and, you know, what the Seattle Police Department's role is going to be. Will they stand down, et cetera? But, you know, I mean, I think the idea that Harrell is going to stand up to Trump is belied a little bit by some things that he said about Trump. You know, when Trump came in, he said that he would work with him. And then later on, actually this year, the mayor said to the at a downtown Seattle Association meeting that Trump was bringing lots of smart innovators like Elon Musk into his administration. And I was going to say he didn't praise him, but he kind of did. You know, he said, we know that our current president surrounds himself by some of the smartest innovators around. When we drop names like Mark Andreessen or Peter Thiel or David Sachs or Elon Musk, these are smart innovators. And so I think his instinct is always to kind of try to get along and be buddy-buddy. And I don't think his instinct is to fight against, the federal administration. He's been a little harsher lately. Saying he's going to fight his racist ass in the same debate where he made the comment about hope and how we can't have hope. But yeah, I mean, I don't think his instinct I think it's really more go along to get along.
Well, I was there at that DSA State of Downtown event, and yeah, that was an eyebrow-raising comment at the time, I think.
I mean, it was kind of a pin drop moment.
Yeah. I do think.
I mean, I looked at it. What he said afterwards, and I asked Jamie Howson about this, was that in larger context, what he was actually trying to say, and I think it's a reasonable reading, honestly, but I know neither of you agree with me, but just to remember that, he was basically saying, these guys are successful people and it's scary that they're in Trump's orbit. The context was he was talking about how much he disliked Trump and was concerned about Trump, not praising Trump, Erica. So that part is true.
Yeah. I mean, I put the video up on Publicola so everybody could see.
He wasn't saying, oh, I love Trump.
He didn't say I love Trump. That's true. That's why I put the video up when I wrote about this. And I also quoted Jamie Howson saying a similar thing after the fact.
Right. And that is what their explanation for it was. I don't know. I was in the room. I think if that was the intent, it landed really wrong, right? I mean, it just sounded wrong to a lot of people. Anyway.
Yeah, but just to defend myself, David, I did not take him out of context. I ran the video and everything. So, and I quoted Jamie.
No, just now it was a little out of context. That's why I was adding it.
Yeah,
because you were both leaving out that context. It was their defense. I'm not really taking a position.
Yeah, I mean, the fact defense doesn't really compete with what it sounds like in the room when you watch it.
I thought it was a plausible explanation for what he said. I still do, but anyway.
Yeah, but well, I was there anyway. I don't want to hash over that. I will just say sometimes the mayor.
You were there. You were there, and so you had the experience.
I had the lived experience of hearing him say, "Yes, I did. I did."
Okay.
So, look, coming back to the more this comment that Erica is Instagramming, like obviously that's also like kind of poorly worded, like. Like, he's like, great ideas? This is not the time for great ideas? What do you mean? When is the time for great ideas? Obviously, that's not what he meant. What he means is this is not the time for untested, you know, I don't know. He could have had used a different kind of description there of what he was trying to say.
He says, this is not the time to hope. I mean,
yeah, this is not the time to hope.
He said, and to be clear, he's said things like this before. This is not
the time
like
to despair.
This has been a criticism of him for a long time now in this campaign that, you know, his argument is basically she is proposing too many big things that can't be done. And I am here to tell you, we can't do big things. We can only do what is possible. And I will bring you stability and I will continue doing what I've done in 4 years as mayor. Give me 4 more years. And so I don't think that, you know, I think it is badly worded, David, but I think he's been saying similar things at, I mean, I've been watching so many of these debates and he says something like that almost every time.
I agree with that. But the one statement I agree with is this is not the time to hope, because I think unfortunately neither one of these candidates, the mayor or Katie Wilson, is really going to be able to do that much to stand up against Trump. So yes, he hasn't done that much. And I don't think she's going to be able to do that much. The only people that will be able to stop Trump are basically Congress and the next president, possibly the Supreme Court. But I don't know that the city of Seattle is going to be able to do that much. I mean, what do we have in mind when we say he's not standing up to Trump, and what is the next administration going to do differently would be my question for both of you, because I'm feeling pretty hopeless right now about what's happening.
So, well, I think one thing specifically is to get rid of the CCTV cameras that Bruce Harrell is putting all over the city. And I think that really is going to be a potential problem if the Trump administration realizes Seattle exists. I don't know if they have yet, but I think that is one thing, very concrete thing that would change immediately, you know, or very quickly. Or that Katie Wilson would at least try to change very quickly.
Well, the eye of Sauron did turn towards us briefly last week. He suggested moving the World Cup games out of Seattle, right? That you know, he doesn't have anything to do with FIFA and the World Cup, and it's not. I'm pretty sure the games aren't going to move out of Seattle, but Trump did sort of blather on that like the game should be removed from Seattle because Seattle was too dangerous or whatever. So
I'm just going to say this press conference, though, where Harrell and Nick Brown and everybody else gets up there and says, stay out of Seattle. I mean, if anything's going to bring Trump to Seattle, it's that. You know, I mean, how is that going to help?
Well, I mean, that was just fist-shaking press conferences are also a thing that I consider to be a waste of time. But, you know, it's like as much of a waste of time as like a meeting that could have been an email. I mean, I don't know. Okay, stay out of Seattle. Thanks.
If you wanted him to come here so that you can save your, you know, maybe it would help Harrell if Trump invades tomorrow.
I think that is part of the calculus, that being the most vocally kind of fist shaking at Trump right now is what you need to do to kind of win an election in November. And I think his campaign has realized that he was too clearly sounding too accommodating towards Trump earlier, and that has hurt him politically. And so they're trying to do a 180 on this stuff. So, whether or not it actually precipitates Trump actually doing stuff, you know, I don't know. We'll see. I will say this, going back to Erica's point, I think Erica's putting her finger on something that's fundamentally right about the fundamental argument that we're kind of hearing in this campaign is the mayor saying, in this time of risk and danger and assault from Trump, we need a steady hand and stability. And Katie is saying, no, we need bold change. And, you know, and certainly if you look at the primary results, it seems like maybe she has the better of that argument politically in terms of what voters want, but I guess we'll find out. But yes, I do think that's the central dynamic of the race. And I do think secondarily, this attack on experience, from what I'm hearing, feels to me like this is emerging as the centerpiece of the mayor's argument against the mayor's campaign's argument against Katie Wilson to the voters. So they're going there and saying, she's just, you can't, you know, boy, it's too risky. She doesn't have any experience. She's not going to be able to deal with Trump. She's not going to be able to run a bureaucracy of 13,000 people. And you know, boy, you know, it's just a big, big, you know, risky leap into the unknown if you actually vote for her. That seems to be the argument that they're going to be making.
Yeah, I want to make one point about that we haven't brought up. I mean, I will say, like, again, having watched a bunch of these debates, they do get a little repetitive. But one thing that really jumps out is that Harrell has an attitude towards Katie Wilson that comes across as incredibly contemptuous and condescending. And that is, you know, I think reflected in the fact that he, you know, often will not refer to her by her name, even though she refers to him by his name. And, you know, and just kind of like waving his hand and saying, you know, if you vote for her, you know, she'll ruin everything. And I'm a steady hand and I know what I'm doing and she doesn't know anything. And he really, you know, in ways kind of big and small, he tries to make her sound like an idiot who's never done anything. And he has gotten to this, you know, point where his soundbite is often, you know, she's never done anything with housing. She's never done anything. I did the minimum wage. I mean, he claimed to be behind the minimum wage increase, which is new one to me recently. And, you know, and she just, she has no experience with anything. And like, you know, Katie Wilson, like, ran a successful nonprofit that still exists that got minimum wages increased in a number of suburban cities. And she led on the Progressive Revenue Task Force. And, you know, I mean, he just seems to be really disgusted by the idea that he has to sit up there and, you know, next to this woman who, you know, who he portrays as just this, you know, this blithering idiot. And it's very obvious that that's not who she is when you hear her talk. I don't know. What do you guys think? Am I overreading that? Have you watched these debates?
I'm not at the debate, so I can't really hear his tone. I mean, like you said at the very beginning, it's kind of the obvious line of attack. How much confidence do voters in cities have right now in establishment Democrats with that kind of message of like, we just need to stay the course? Or are people kind of feeling like, no, you guys are fucking it up. It's why we're in the mess we're in right now. So I don't know what the voters' mood is, but it seems like in these primaries we're seeing something like that. And so I'm not sure doubling down on establishment experiences is going to work, but we'll see.
I'll just add to Erica's point about the sort of tonally how the mayor is coming across, right? I mean, we've talked about this before, like the Bruce Harrell has certainly demonstrated at many times in the past that he can be that he has real talent for retail politics, right? He can do this sort of speak to a crowd, speak to a room, and come across in this charismatic, you know, kind of self-deprecating, you know, jokey.
Like that Sonics joke that I was the only one who liked.
I like the Sonics joke too. I actually think he gets a bad rap on the basketball thing. That was
I literally laughed at that.
I thought it was funny. I thought that was
in
good.
My home by myself.
Yeah, I was
anyway.
Like, people need to lighten up. That was pretty good, actually, on his part. But no, but he, you know, he. We've all seen him when he's on, and he's pretty good in rooms and has a sort of commanding presence and is likable and stuff. But he's also sometimes prone, and I do really feel like he got kind of blindsided by the Katie Wilson campaign and threat. I think he and his campaign thought that they were kind of at the beginning of this sailing to reelection. And so we're seeing a little too much of a more, you know, prickly side of the mayor and some of this. And I do think, to Erica's point, there's a little bit of that tonal stuff that's like, yeah, that's not the, you know, happy, fun-loving, filling the city with love mayor, right, that got elected in 2021.
Well, and for somebody who's been accused of being a misogynist and running a boys' club, it's not a great look.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I'll just say that.
Whether this is rooted in, you know, misogyny or not, I'm not going there with it, but it just doesn't.
I'm just talking about how it looks.
I agree that it just doesn't come across as the sort of warm and winning kind of version of the mayor that
it's,
you know,
tough. It's tough. like I'm just imagining how you criticize your opponent for their lack of experience and not come across. I mean, it's a tough, it'd be a hard attack to deliver. I wouldn't do it if I were him. I would have my surrogates do it. I'd do it in my mail. I think he shouldn't do it at all. I think it's a political mistake for him to even try it.
It is hard. The mayor obviously feels like he has to go on the attack. He has to take down the front runner in the race, who's now Katie Wilson. And it is challenging to go negative face to face with your opponent in a kind of intimate, like, you know, you're on stage together in a debate setting. But good politicians figure out how to do that, right? Zoran Mamdani, like, attacked Andrew Cuomo pretty much every day in the race in the New York City, you know, primary, and he did it with a smile and came across as this kind of fun, charismatic guy, right? As he's sort of trashing Cuomo as a, you know, a scandal-plagued hack or whatever. And like, so it's possible to do, but you gotta bring the right emotional valence to it.
It doesn't seem like that kind of sharp attack with delivered with a smile has ever really been Harrell's forte. It's not his thing. You know, it's like one Seattle kind of everybody, I'm here to bring people together. And then I'm going to do whatever it is that I'm going to do.
Well, we've never had to see him run from behind. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
Okay. Well, we've learned a lot. Read more at publicola.com. That's it for another edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde. She's Erica Barnett. He's Sandeep Kaushik. Our editor is Quinn Waller. And thanks everybody so much for listening.